Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.
Dan Bernstein and Layla Rahimi, Wednesdays from 9 a.m. to noon on Sports Radio 670 The Score.
So Brandon was in the last year of his contract. He'd be an unrestricted free agent at the end of the contract. So with where he's at, $6 million, that was not a player that we were going to continue on after this year. We're trying to get more flexibility, we're trying to get younger players. For me, 25-year-old defenseman is young. I guess you have a different take on that.
Ooh, apparently so. A little salty there from Blackhawks general manager Stan Bowman talking with Laz and Powers on the Athletics Laz and Powers podcast. This segment is brought to you by PropSwap, and Mark Lazarus, the senior writer at the Athletic, joins us on the Alpamonte Ford hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. Hello, Laz, how are you?
I'm well. How are you doing?
I'm good, but I don't get it. I know he says rebuild our depth. That doesn't mean rebuild with a capital R. But as long as there are four very well-known names with affiliated and associated with a whole lot of winning for a long, long time, you're not rebuilding until you're rebuilding.
Yeah, I mean, nothing new happened yesterday. The only thing that new happened yesterday was that they acknowledged that they're in this process. This process started a long time ago. You could say a couple of years ago, I had one player text me. It happened the second they traded Robin Leonard, when they basically admitted they weren't trying to win anymore and they were thinking more long term. This is not a true rebuild. This is not a tear it down to the studs Detroit Red Wings style rebuild. The Hawks are not going to have 48 points next year, or whatever it is that the Red Wings were on pace for. $33.5 million tied up in four superstars who have won a combined 12 Stanley Cups. So this is not going to be a true rebuild, but there's at least an acknowledgement that they're in it. That there's a long-term process at play here. That they're not going to win the Stanley Cup in 2021. And they're not going to win the Stanley Cup in 2022. And it's going to be a long time before they get back up to that mountain.
Yeah, I think that was the takeaway for us, Mark, was just trying to figure out where this stood and what they were doing, if it was really anything different. And I just came away from it thinking they're already explaining, or they've explained what they've already been doing, but that you can't really rebuild if you're not going to get rid of those particular players. If you're not getting rid of that core, you can't really call it a rebuild.
Right. And well, that's what Stan's saying. He's saying we're trying to rebuild around those guys, basically, that we don't want them to have to carry the load that they've been carrying. You know, ideally, a 37-year-old Duncan Keith shouldn't be playing 27 minutes a night still, but he has been because there's been nobody else. So I think in their mind, the rebuild is let's build up the guys around them. Let's get Kirby Dach to take some of that off of Jonathan Toews' plate. Let's get Dominic Kubalik and Alex DeBrincat to take a little bit off of Patrick Kane's plate. Let's get Ian Mitchell in here. Let's get Nikita Zadorov in here. Let's get this defense a little more stout to help take some of the pressure off some of those guys up front. Let's bring in a Matthias Janmark and a Lucas Wallmark to shore up that team defense in the bottom six a little bit. They're not really getting younger. You know, Zadorov's 25, Janmark, I think, is 25, Wallmark's 27, something like that. These are like middle-aged in hockey terms. But they're trying to take the pressure off Kane, Taves, and Keith, essentially. That's what the rebuild is. That's when he says rebuild their depth. It's an awkward way of saying we're trying to get these other guys better and improve from within so they can take some of the pressure off of those older guys.
I ended up talking myself into a strategy that Layla described as sort of a cynical breakup strategy. And I didn't mean to do it that way. And maybe this is cynical, but it might also be good business if you're really trying to win another championship. Instead of building up the middle, instead of solidifying, why not get worse and maybe make it such that one of these no movement clauses would be more likely to be waived by a proud professional who wants to go compete for a better chance at a Stanley Cup now while they still can?
Well, I don't think that's so crazy. And I think that's kind of the perception. I think, you know, I talked to Jonathan Toews last week about this, and Toews talking out of school like that was significant because he clearly was not happy and had something to say. That's not something he would normally do. But for what I had heard was that the core guys felt that that's what was happening, that they felt that management was trying to make this team bad so they'd be willing to waive their no movement clauses. Now, Toews did not say that at all to me when I talked to him. And he said he's not going to waive his no movement clause. But the idea was these players are going to band together and say, you know what, F that. We're here for the long haul. They're going to have to pay us what they owe us. I don't know quite how combative it got and what that disconnect was. Stan Bowman said he had a nice talk with the guys over Zoom since Toews' comments came out in my story and that everyone's on the same page here. I don't think this team's going to get that bad that they want out. I mean, the goaltending situation is terrifying. You've got three completely unproven guys behind the worst defense in the league. Corey Crawford and Robin Leonard masked a lot of problems and made this team competitive. They propped them up. It's not going to be good for a little while here, but there is talent here. Patrick Kane is still one of the five or six best players in the world. Dominic Kubalik scored 30 goals in a shortened season. Alex DeBrincat had a 41-goal season before he kind of got snake-bit last year. There's still a lot of talent. Kirby Dach is going to take a next step. He's going to be a star. Dylan Strome is going to be a perfectly good third-line center. There's talent on this team. They are not some horrible, god-awful mess of a team. They're just in that mushy middle, just outside the playoff picture. And the problem is the Central Division's gotten better. So they're not going to be a disaster, but they're not going to be a playoff team. And they're not going to be certainly a contender for a number of years now. Now, it's up to the core guys to decide if they want to do that. Toews told me in no uncertain terms he's not waiving his no-movement clause. I have a hard time seeing Kane do the same thing, waiving his clause. The one I could see would be Duncan Keith. I talked to him at the last two trade deadlines, and both times he said the same thing. I don't want to go anywhere, but I don't want to be part of a rebuild where the Chicago Blackhawks, we should be trying to win. It's exactly what he said. So maybe if things are really bad by the trade deadline, whatever that is in this next season, maybe that's a name that could be moved. He'd be the most attractive player because he's on an easy contract, $5.5 million for a guy who's still a good top four defenseman. He's got some years left in him. Rings in the room, as they say. Duncan Keith could be traded. I'm not sure you can trade Jonathan Toews. I'm not sure you'd want to trade Patrick Kane. And Brent Seabrook, unless Seattle is willing to take some kind of sweetheart deal in the expansion draft, he's not going anywhere either. So a lot of this is moot.
Yeah, and I think we've bet on that. Is Duncan Keith going to get traded watch for a while now, Laz? I know you and I have talked about it on shows before. Mm-hmm. And that's something that really, I think, might be the key point in all of this as far as the core changing. But you brought up, I think, one of my biggest concerns about this Blackhawks team, and it has been now for the past couple of years, is the defense. And now you're in a goalie situation where you have three guys who have a combined 76 NHL games in Delia and then Lankinen and Subban. What do you do there if you're the Blackhawks?
Well, I mean, the way Stan Bowman, he tried to frame it positively in that, you know, hey, Corey Crawford needed his opportunity in 2010-11. He was in the minors for 5 years and, you know, paid his dues and it was his turn and he took it and he ran with it. All three of these guys have a good pedigree. They've all been AHL All-Stars. Malcolm Subban was a first-round draft pick. Kevin Lankinen won the world championships for Finland. These are good. And Colin Delia played in the NHL and looked good. There's a high ceiling on all of these guys, but this is a really tough situation to throw a young goalie in. What's their psyche going to be the first time they face 52 shots in a game and give up 7 goals despite playing well? Confidence goes a long way when you're a young goalie, and it's going to be hard to be confident behind this defense. And that's what the Walmart and Janmark, these signings are meant to kind of ease that pressure on the goalie because the defense theoretically should be a little bit better. But it's going to take a total change in team concept from top to bottom, from the first line to the third pairing to make this a better defensive team. We've seen it. The New York Islanders 3 years ago were the worst defensive team in the league. Barry Trotz came in, and they immediately became the best defensive team in the league. It can be done. But is Jeremy Collison the guy to be able to do that? We're going to find out because he's been here 2 years and the defense is still bad.
If you want to see our guest, Mark Lazarus, you can on our Twitch feed. It is twitch.tv/Chicago670 The Score if you want to join that viewership and conversation that goes on as well. I want to talk about the meta story here, too. And that is, who's running the Blackhawks, who's in charge of hockey operations, who will be in charge, and if any of this would be then undone by somebody coming in with some sort of different philosophy. But it just seems weird anytime, and I mentioned this before, when you're a reporter and a team is using the word transparency. It's one thing to just be transparent. That's your relationship, and you know that's how they work. It's another thing to go, we're going to be transparent on this. It's like when someone says, you know what, let me tell you the truth. It's like, well, have you been telling me the truth before? You know, I'm just sort of questioning about it. This whole roadshow concept that Bowman is on here, what does it say about the direction of the team in general that they're doing this in the way that they're doing it?
Well, I think there's a couple of aspects to that. I mean, for one thing, John McDonough ran the most secretive team in the NHL. I don't mean secretive in some sinister, nefarious way. The Blackhawks just didn't give you anything. They didn't give the national writers anything. They didn't give the local reporters anything. They didn't give the fans anything. You were not privy to what they were thinking and why they did things. It's just the way they operate. And that's fine when you're great. When you're winning, nobody's going to call you on that. But when you're bad, when you're struggling, you know, you have to be a little more open with the process. We saw the New York Rangers did this a couple of years ago, where they were the first to come up with kind of a letter to the fans saying, look, it's going to be bad for a little while, but we're working on it. We promise you. I think Danny Wirtz has come in, and he's been big on this whole transparency thing. I mean, I've talked to Stan Bowman 1,000 times over the years, and you know, he's a difficult guy to talk to. He doesn't give you a whole lot, but I thought yesterday he was a little more open. He was like, I asked him about the brand. How do you square the Brandon Saad trade with the idea of a rebuild when you got no picks and no prospects? He goes, I'll tell you in detail. And he went on a long spiel about why he made the trade, why Brandon Saad wasn't going to come back next year, the money reasons, the Zadorovac. He explained in detail the plan, which was interesting because he's never done that before. So I think there's something to that. When you're struggling, you need to be more open. Now, there's also the other factor that there's not going to be any fans at the United Center this year. Let's face it. There's no way you're going to have fans. They're not selling tickets this year. So if you're ever going to have that year where you say, we're going to be stinky for a while, you do it in the year, you don't have to sell tickets anyway. You're going to lose money anyway. So a lot of this is fortuitous timing. A lot of it is Danny Wirtz wants to push that transparency. He believes in that more than John McDonough did. A lot of it is Stan Bowman is, you know, working to keep his job. And, you know, I don't think he's on the hot seat at all. I know a lot of fans want him to be, but you don't get to write that letter and then go on a media tour if you're not being trusted to become the guy to lead that rebuild. He's in it for the long haul. Ownership believes in him. Danny Wirtz believes in him. He's the guy. So I think there's a lot of factors that went into this whole quote-unquote transparency thing. I'm curious to see if it lasts beyond this week. I hope it does. It's beneficial to fans. It's beneficial to us. And it's beneficial to Bowman to be more open about what they're thinking and why they're doing things. But it's very un-Blackhawky, and it's going to be very interesting to see how it proceeds.
Yeah, it's funny because this is a tough story to explain in a very short amount of time as to why it's significant. Like, it just kind of sounds like somebody talked and here's what they said, and we're telling you it's important that they talked. But in reality, the nuance here is the story. And that was something that I asked Dan about even before we had our show, Laz, was what does this mean for Bowman? And it would indicate that he's got more autonomy than he had previously.
Yeah. If anything, he's consolidated power, if anything.
Right.
I mean, when John McDonough was fired, my first thought was, oh, they're going to bring in a president of hockey operations, a Brendan Shanahan type, to oversee Stan Bowman, to have final call on things and to hiring and firing power. That was my initial, this is what it has to be. They haven't made the playoffs in all these years. That's not what's happened. Stan Bowman is still very much in charge of hockey ops in this team. Whether it's Danny Wirtz himself or someone else, it sounds like there's going to be a more business side president of the team, like a John McDonough type, who's going to be more worried about the business than the hockey ops. This is still Stan Bowman's team. He has autonomy, he has the authority, and he's got the backing of management. So if anything has come out of these last few months, it's that Stan Bowman, he's the man in the Blackhawks' eyes, and he's not going anywhere.
Laz, great stuff. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
It's Mark Lazarus, senior writer at The Athletic. The segment brought to you by Toro Snowblowers. For grizzly winters, you need a Toro Power Max snowblower. It's a beast on snow. Act now. Get up to $100 off on select Toro Power Max snowblowers. See your Toro retailer now. Win winter with a Toro. Let's get back to some Bears talk. If you need your pump-up song, if you need Dreams and Nightmares from Meek Mill, we can just sort of have that coursing through your veins if it's going to help energize our Bears talk here.
Shout out to Meek.
But there's something that we talked about yesterday. I'm going to bring back something that Sage Rosenfeld said yesterday, and it's been percolating through Bears discussion now that we're finally coming to a realization of, of what may have to happen. I don't think it's going to, but this is the consideration about when you realize your defense may be something other than just good, when it may be special, how that changes the offense's responsibilities. We'll talk about all of that next on The Score.
Third and goal from inside the one. Montgomery in the backfield. Chicago.
A big breath of fresh air. Nagy can finally breathe again because he's saying, what call do I have to make to finally score a rushing touchdown from the one-inch yard line? Cody Whitehair getting a good push up front.
So now the Bears have scored in the third quarter.
Not bad. It took officially have
some extra time.
Meek Mill song on in the locker room. It reminded me of, you know, Philly a little bit, you know. So I'm not going to lie, that got my juices going. So shout out to Meek. Was it Dreams and Nightmares? So it brought back a memory for me that was exciting. And then I might have got up and danced a little bit. I'm more like country, maybe some Christian rap, but I'll tell you what, if Meek comes on with that song, I get rolling.
I'll ask some questions about Christian rap at another time, probably, because I'm not quite...
Lecrae is a popular artist.
Okay.
There you go. That's your starter kit.
I might have got up and danced a little bit. I'm more like country, maybe some Christian rap, but I'll tell you what, if Meek comes on with that song, I get rolling.
It's so good.
Christian rap?
No, well, I was referring to Meek.
Okay. Oh, okay.
We got to get Lawrence on to talk about hype songs, because I have a feeling he's in.
Oh, we will. We'll talk to him. So as we get
shout out to Meek.
As we get into some Bears conversation here, I think we should listen back to what was said yesterday by our quarterback whisperer on this show, Sage Rosenfels, a former NFLer. Just a couple minutes here, him talking about the Bears and identity or lack thereof in their offense.
Well, they have an identity. It's not good.
It's not a good identity. I mean?
It's not like identity that you want to have. They don't have much of a run game. I saw a little criticism on David Montgomery on Twitter yesterday, and I was a little bit beside myself. Is he Walter Payton? No, he is not Sweetness, okay? But he is a good back. He catches the ball in the backfield. He gets more yards after contact, and I think Bears fans do appreciate that. He gets hit at maybe 2 yards. And somehow power through for a 4, 5, 6, 7 yard gain. He does that regularly. There's not a lot there. The Bears, let's start with the running game. For the most part, they run more inside zone than outside zone, which does rely on basically offensive line push. This is not super challenging for a defense to play against inside zone running teams as far as like gap responsibilities are concerned. They're just coming right at you. The outside zone is where you have to sort of run with the offensive line. And if somebody gets cut off, there's a big gash there as the offensive line sort of runs down the line and the fullback and the tight end and that whole thing. But they run a lot of inside zone, which basically relies on push, which basically relies on there's usually not going to be a lot there. Just sort of the way it goes. It's not conducive to big plays, if that makes sense. Off of that, they don't do a lot of play action off that. Usually they have some luck when they do call it, but it seems like it's about twice a game, maybe 3 times a game where they actually call a play action that does look like one of their inside zone running plays. So you don't have much of a running game, and then you don't have much of a play action game because of that lack of running game, which then leaves you to throwing the football, straight drop back pass. And you can drop as many plays as you want. So, you know, as every quarterback's coach and offensive coordinator and quarterback, you spend a week and, you know, this is the coverage that they're in and we got this matchup, we want to do this. And you have this passing game plan. But if you can't protect the quarterback, it doesn't matter what pass plays you have. It doesn't matter at all. You can drop all the beautiful things and try to get guys open. But if you have no protection, you will have no passing game.
That's some intense stuff from Sage, some truth-telling right there. And if the discussion that sort of spawned, that ensued, regarded, okay, are we really doing this again? Are we really going to have to reconcile the fact that this team is going to go as far as its defense takes it, and it's time for the offense to manage the game and not try to be everything Matt Nagy thought it would be, and just make sure it does everything they can do to help the defense win the game, to not lose, to get short fields, to get turnovers, et cetera. It'll never happen because Nagy always has these offensive sugar plums dancing in his head. Everything's got to be wonderful and great and solve the next puzzle and score all the points. And I understand that. But the only way you can really do that, the only way you can make sure that the defense is maximized is by limiting risk, is by making sure you're not turning it over, you're not throwing stupid passes, that you're grinding possessions that can allow the defense to rest. I just wonder, are the Bears ready to confront the reality that they've got to run their offense in a way that allows their defense to dominate?
I think this question gets answered by some pretty simple decisions. And I think before the end of the game, there was a lot of frustration because we saw the three and out take place where the Bears took only 15 seconds off of the clock. And they could have run the ball in that situation to take it off more time off the clock. That would have allowed the Bears defense to be on the field less time and thusly given the Panthers less chance to score. But the Bears defense was so good, we know they came up with a huge interception, so it was a moot point. However, if they didn't have that interception, what happens there? You're focused on that three and out, and Nagy, again, choosing to pass rather than run in a clock management situation. And I think that that's the point of emphasis that frustrated a lot of people. I completely understand what Sage Rosenfels is talking about, but there's a way to mask some of this. And I tried to look up the Bears' explosive play stats, by the way, just to see where they were in that. I couldn't get to it quick enough because it made me think, how many explosive plays are they generating? Those are game-winning plays, usually the game changers. But to me, like, there's simple things that Nagy could do as far as clock management that doesn't put the defense in as peril-filled of a situation.
Maybe I'm operating on a false premise. Is it possible that the concept of complementary defensive offensive football is a canard? That, because I'm kind of arguing against myself right now, because one could think, forget it. If you score all the points, if you still can really maximize what you do and you think you can get this stuff blocked up, the best thing for your defense would be a touchdown. The best thing you can do is score. And it's one thing to say, well, we can win games 17-13. Win them 50-0. You know, always try to win every game 50-0. Or is that just living in a fantasy world when you can't block anybody? I'm just wondering what's real and what's not.
Well, I mean,
even if Matt Nagy were to say, listen, the emperor wears no clothes. My offense doesn't work. The defense is great. It wasn't supposed to work this way, but let's figure out a way to make it work. He's never going to say that. But even if he did, what would really change?
Well, essentially what you're talking about is like a Clemson or an Alabama, which doesn't exist in the NFL. But
right.
You're also alluding to something that Foles talked about in that epic post-game press conference that we discussed, which is, you know, if you're scoring 50 points in a loss, you're still scoring 50 points in a loss. The problem is they're two different units, and you talk about assignment-based football. But we saw Nagy acquiesce a little bit when we saw him run the ball more because Mitch Trubisky was under center.
We saw it last year with I formation.
And I love play action. I'm obsessed with play action. But you know what you have to do in order to have play action work? You have to run the ball on first down. There were 7 running plays in that first half. That's it. Carolina was 25th against the run going into that game. I love it. I love all of the fun things. But just run the ball a little bit more, and a lot of these problems become solved. You don't rush Foles the way the Panthers did either if you expect there might be a run play. You do that when you know that he's dropping back to pass. But I don't think that the defense predicates any of it.
That's what I mean. Like, when we love the idea of it being interrelated, it may not be, with the exception of the play that you point out, with the exception of the idea of run the clock, get the game over sooner, rather than trying to accomplish something on offense that you probably aren't going to.
Because you're asking the defense to do more in those situations, and they've already done so much for you. That's where I feel like it's related. But the whole game, yeah, of course, if the defense makes a huge play, that's the momentum. That's everything.
And I guess you're not thinking, when the offense takes the field, they just know it's their turn. They have the ball. They're not thinking, well, what can we do now to help our defense? They're thinking, what can we do to gain yards? It's like, I'm trying to get my head around all of these possibilities here, that even if they admitted to themselves what they may be. You know, Mulligan talks about this all the time. Figure out what you have to do to win the game.
Yeah, but that's a coaching process. So let's work that out a little bit. So okay. The coach says, here's our philosophy for this week. what if he says time of possession is going to be a big deal? Let's keep our defense off the field as long as possible. Well, okay, so the players know that, but their job is, what play are we running in this scenario right now? Where are my blocks? Where are my reads? You know, if you work it through, their job is to just execute every single play, but that's a coaching question.
And then regardless of what you plan, we know from Nagy that even if he'll say, we got to run the ball here, we got to run the ball here, he doesn't like live to fight another day. He's like, ooh, wait a second. I know this play that's going to get me 16 yards right here because Anthony Miller's going to be over here. We'll throw it behind the line of scrimmage and we're going to get a pick play here. That's just, even if that's his intent, he sometimes gets off of that in a given game because he's so tantalized by the moment.
And I know that a lot of people want to hate on the announcers. I actually thought Jonathan Vilma brought it.
It's pretty good.
On Sunday. I think he made a lot of valid points. And he talked about run-pass options, which we all know are a key mark of this offense, and how a lot of them end up being passes rather than runs. But again, that's a coaching thing, right? Like, Foles is taking what the defense is giving him on that play.
When we come back, I have some breaking news here. And this is real, and it involves something that this may be a bit of a spoiler alert for the new Borat movie, but this apparently has now hit the news about a major figure in American politics who apparently got absolutely clowned and maybe dangerously so in the new Borat movie. And we talked about Borat when we played some of the trailer already. I'm just read the first three graphs, and you're not going to want to miss this because, oh boy, somebody got, and in a bad way. I'll let you know about it next on The Score.
About a year ago, I released a movie film which brought great shame to Kazakhstan. But now I was instructed to return to Yankee Land to carry out secret mission.
I go to America!
What do you say? No, it's not me.
Borat, come back!
People make recognize my face. I would need disguises.
This man is a sex criminal?
No, I'm not a sex criminal.
I will take this to be a fat like American man.
Yeah? This is a good one. Where is Iskram?
I don't know where Iskram is. Have to find.
We're going to have to deal with you in the Borat movie for months, maybe.
You're still dealing with me in the first Borat movie from 2000, whatever it was.
I do love the scene where he puts the chicken in the drawer at the hotel.
It's also great. And this, apparently, and I will say that this may be a spoiler alert, but it's news. Oh boy. This is from The Guardian. The reputation of Rudy Giuliani could be set for a further blow with the release of highly embarrassing footage in Sacha Baron Cohen's follow-up to Borat. In the film, released on Friday, the former New York mayor and current personal attorney to Donald Trump is seen reaching into his trousers and apparently touching his while reclining on a bed in the presence of the actor playing Borat's daughter, who is posing as a TV journalist. Following an obsequious interview for a fake conservative news program, the pair retreat at her suggestion for a drink to the bedroom of a hotel suite, which is rigged with concealed cameras. After she removes his microphone, Giuliani, 76, can be seen lying back on the bed, fiddling with his untucked shirt and reaching into his trousers. They are then interrupted by Borat, who runs in and says, "She's 15. She's too old for you." Representatives for Giuliani have not replied to The Guardian's requests for comment. Word of the incident first emerged on July 7th. When Giuliani called New York police to report the intrusion of an unusually dressed man. This guy comes running in wearing a crazy, what I would say was a pink transgender outfit, Giuliani told the New York Post. It was a pink bikini with lace underneath a translucent mesh top. It looked absurd. He had a beard, bare legs, and wasn't what I would call distractingly attractive. This person comes in yelling and screaming. I thought this must be a scam or a shakedown, so I reported it to the police. Then he ran away. The police found no crime had been committed.
Great success.
Oh, man.
Oh, no. Oh,
I like how you tried to talk to me about this, or I tried to talk to you during the break, and I'm like, what happened? And you're like, I just want you to react to this. And my reaction is, silence. What is this? It's like not even real, but it's real.
This is, I can't wait for this movie.
No, you cannot. Like, this is going to be the Dan Bernstein / Borat 2 preview show for the next couple weeks.
Yeah,
I'm convinced.
And I don't want to ruin it, but that's news when that's out there. I mean, the Twitter responses who are quote tweeting this Guardian tweet. Oh.
So the crime was wearing the outfit?
There was no crime.
Right, but
I don't
like
know what
his idea of the crime was wearing the outfit? Because it sounds like there was a bigger crime going on than that.
I don't know if there's any crime here, but it does seem a bit untoward, I would put it that way.
Oh, man.
You have some questions for Lawrence Holmes upcoming, and they will be asked in transition in moments on The Score.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.